Your silence is commanding.
Please be seated. I'll call the third case for today, 2005 AP 3087 CR, State of Wisconsin versus Hambly. Arguing on behalf of the defendant, Mr. Hambly, is Assistant State Public Defender Martha Askins. Ms. Askins.
Thank you. Good afternoon. May it please the court, my name is Martha Askins. I appear on behalf of Scott Hambly, and I am an assistant state public defender here in Madison. I'm asking the court on behalf of Scott Hambly to reverse the trial court's decision which denied Scott Hambly's motion to suppress. I ask the court to vacate his conviction and to order a new trial. I further ask the court to hold that Scott Hambly made an incriminating statement while he was in custody and subject to interrogation and after he had clearly invoked his right to counsel. The events in this case took place back in September of 2003. Scott Hambly was returning to his apartment with food he had just purchased. He was approached by two police officers who told him they wanted to talk with him about some drug transactions he was involved in. They were not in uniform, by the way. They did have their customary guns, and they were in an unmarked car or near an unmarked car. Mr. Hambly, my client, says he did not want to talk. When he said they should come back another day, they arrested him. At that point, he asked for an attorney, and the officers began to escort him back to their squad car. My position is that Scott Hambly's interrogation did not cease at that point, although the law required it to be ceased at that point, that he did not initiate or volunteer any information to the police, and that he did not knowingly and voluntarily waive his right to counsel at any time. Having invoked the right to counsel, he never waived it. Therefore, the prosecution should have been barred from using his incriminating statements that he made against him at trial. I'm asking the court to implement a bright line rule today. Whereas here the defendant is in custody, subject to interrogation, and requests counsel, if he subsequently begins to talk to the police, the officer should clarify he does not have to talk and ensure that the suspect intends to waive that previously invoked right to counsel. Since under our case law, invocation of the right to counsel must be unequivocal, similarly, the waiver must be unequivocal. I would point the court not only to the comments that the trial court made in its decision on the motion to suppress, but also to the judge's sentencing comments. He believed that what occurred in this case was, he was pretty hard on the police department in this case, or on the Washington County Drug Unit. He said that he believed the police had essentially created a crime to get Scott Hambly to give them some names. And that, to me, is key. And so for that reason, I'll quote directly what he said. He was talking about the fact that my client had his bag of McDonald's and he was hungry and he wanted to eat. And he says, no reason to treat Scott Hambly or anybody, especially considering they were investigating not the crime of the history, but an extremely, extremely minor offense, which they created in order to get Scott to give them some names. I mean, we all know that's what was happening here. And that's at page 26 of the sentencing transcript. He thinks, he said further later, that Michael Meyer, who was the informant in this case, I think he dealt with you because he was running out of names and he was trying to protect his own hide. So whether he invented this or whether this really occurred, it's still part of a setup, minor by searching for names. The reason that I quote this is that I'd like to stress the coercive nature of this whole environment. What the law seeks to protect is the interrogation environment. And what was occurring in this case was here was a young man taken, you know, expecting to go home and eat his lunch, taken from his parking lot of his apartment. Two police officers approach him directly. One stands in front of him. One stands behind him. They say, we'd like to talk to you about some drug transaction. He's thinking, and here obviously I'm imagining what he's thinking, but it is, I've got these two cops here who want to talk to me. I'm in trouble. And the key really is, we want to speak with you about some drug transactions. That's why I think he was in an interrogation environment. This was not some police perhaps approaching a group of kids on a sidewalk saying, oh, you know, something just happened. Did you guys see anything? Or could I talk to you about something? This is, we want to talk to you about something you were involved in.
When he says, Askins, can I interrupt you for a minute?
Sure.
As I understand what occurred here, the trial court judge looked at the totality of the circumstances. He weighed the age of your client, his educational background, all of the other factors that the cases talk about. And he came to the conclusion that there was a waiver and that it was a knowing, intelligent, and voluntary one. And yet you're zeroing in on this idea of coercion. Do you think he applied the wrong test?
Well, I think the coercion really goes to whether my client was in custody and subject to interrogation. What Your Honor is referring to, I think, is the judge's ruling that my client waived his right to counsel. And that, of course, is an issue of law that this court will determine independently. Now, certainly, certain facts we know his age, you know, those sorts of things we know. But whether or not the trial court was correct in finding waiver is something for this court to determine independently, of course. I think that lots of times I would be here saying the trial court got everything wrong. I think the trial court got a lot of things right in this case. I think he, again, just as an aside, probably the last few times I've been here, I've been talking about what a trial court didn't say at sentencing. And again, I think the trial court at the sentencing in this case did just a tremendous job of talking about the individual. But that's beside the point. What I think he got wrong here was that having invoked the right to counsel, he had to clearly waive it. And again, I go back to what I said earlier, which is we require a suspect to invoke counsel very clearly. We won't allow an equivocal invocation of the right to counsel. So if it's hard to say, if it's hard for us to say as a matter of law, he asked for a lawyer. Okay, in my case, he did ask for a lawyer. It should be at least as hard to say, having invoked that, he's now waived that. And I don't think in the totality of the circumstances here, my client showed, and I don't think the state can show, that he said, all right, I've invoked the right to counsel. Now I'm knowingly and voluntarily relinquishing this important constitutional right.
Well, is there any real dispute that he first said to the officer, I think it was Rint, something to the effect that he didn't know why he was under arrest. So Rint told him. And then, as I understand it, there had been a mention of his options. And he said, well, tell me about my options. What are my options? This is all taking place, as I understand it, after he's asked for an attorney. Then it's my understanding, and correct me if I'm wrong, it's my understanding that he's given his Miranda warnings, he waives the Miranda rights, he signs a waiver form, and then he talks to the officer for about an hour. Now, it would seem to me that you've got a tough row to hoe in regard to the question of a clear waiver where he's given his Miranda warnings, he signs a waiver form, he doesn't ask for an attorney after that, and he talks to the police officer for an hour. Tell me what I'm missing.
Okay. Well, first of all, and this is the matter of the Miranda form is in dispute. However, the trial court did find that he signed the form, knew what it was. But I would say that my client testified he did not realize what he was signing. He thought it was an arrest warrant. All right. Point number two is, okay, why isn't the Miranda form, why doesn't that solve the waiver problem? And the reason that I think it doesn't solve the waiver problem is twofold. One, there was no interruption of or cessation of the interrogation. I think it's problematic that there wasn't a break, and this I certainly have argued in my briefs to this court and the Court of Appeals, there wasn't a break in this transaction. And without a break, the individual's likelihood to succumb to the coercive pressure of that environment is greatly heightened. The other thing is that, again, what Miranda is protecting against is this self-incrimination in the context of this interrogation environment, this coercive environment. Here what we have is because the officer never stopped talking to him, progresses immediately to the Miranda, Hambly could have been, and I think was, left with the impression that this interaction with this detective is simply not going to stop until I talk to him. Because we back up to the point where he's in the parking lot, he says, I don't want to go to the police station. I don't want to go to my apartment to talk to you. Why don't you come back another day? He's arrested, placed in the car, handcuffed, Miranda form. Because there was a continuing escalation of the coercion, there was never an opportunity for him to say, you know, nothing that he said would make this stop. And that, I think, is what the concern is about the protections that we want to make sure are in place. Every time he tried to say no, the officer came at him with new information. So, sure, on the one hand, the officer is coming at
him. Ms. Askins? Mm-hmm. One of the concerns that I have, when the officer, quote, came at him with new information after he had invoked his right to counsel, wasn't that in response to questions that Mr. Hambly had about why he was in custody, why they were arresting him?
Well, I wish the findings were a little bit more clear about who said what when. But let me just assume that my client said, I'd like to know what options are available to me, and the officer proceeded to give him Miranda warnings. And then my client says, you know, why am I under arrest? The officer at that point can answer his question, but has to do so in a way that does not tend to elicit an incriminating response. I don't know if that exactly answers the...
Well, the reason I'm pressing you is that It would seem to me that when part of the clarification process that exists for clarifying whether or not a person wants to have an attorney there or wants to invoke right to counsel is responding to what the defendant is asking. Mm-hmm. And if the defendant is asking a specific question, why am I under arrest, it would seem to me that if we were to say the officer can't answer that question, we would have a challenge from the other side that, well, wait a minute, how are you clarifying if you're not even giving him the information he's looking for? Mm-hmm.
I think that no rule could be implemented saying that when asked, a police officer may never answer, why am I under arrest? I think that is a logical question that a suspect's going to ask, and I think that to say that the police officer may never answer that is not a rule that would hold up. On the other hand, I think what Edwards says is when the suspect asks for counsel, special additional safeguards are necessary. So if that occurs, the police officer needs to be extremely careful to not say something that would tend to elicit an incriminating response. You know, what was interesting, one of the facts in Bond was the Bond says, you know, why am I under arrest? And he says, I'll tell you that in a minute. Then, of course, we get to the other facts. But what could occur is the officer could say, you've told me you want a lawyer. I'm going to tell you why you're under arrest. But, you know, be clear that if we have a discussion, you're waiving your right to counsel. And I think that that would be, and I don't have magic words that a police officer could say in response to a defendant, but everybody is on notice, that police officer is on notice, that as soon as the police officer hears, I would like a lawyer to help me in interrogation because I'm not capable. I mean, what that means is I'm not capable of talking to you without the assistance of counsel. That when the officer hears those words, the officer should stop and say, you know, put the brakes on this discussion. And that never occurred in this case. So going back originally to your question, Justice Butler, I think ideally the findings of fact in this case would be more clear. As I was trying to parse them out and looking at what Judge Farragher said, he talked about pre-Miranda give and take, that the defendant was trying to kind of figure out how much trouble he was in and so on. Nevertheless, what's important in this case is that once Detective Rint heard Scott Hambly say, I need a lawyer, I want a lawyer, it was incumbent on him to say, don't talk to me anymore, you've told me, just like the police officer did in Bradshaw. Does that answer your question? Sort of. Thank you.
One of the arguments advanced by the state is that these comments were merely anticipatory.
Right.
Can you respond to that? And I also, in part of that response, I note the Fisher case mm-hmm. that's relied upon by the state. And it seems, as advanced by the state, that the Fisher facts are almost more egregious than the facts here. And yet, when you examine the functional equipment.
Sure. First of all, why wasn't Mr. Hambly's invocation of the right to counsel too early? I think that his invocation of the right to counsel was timely because of the words of the detectives and because of the actions of the detectives. My understanding is the first thing they say to him is, we want to speak with you about some drug transactions. In other words, we want to talk to you. And to me, we want to talk to you means we want to interrogate you. It's clear the purpose of the encounter was to talk to him, to get information from him. And if he wasn't willing to talk voluntarily, he was going to be taken into custody. Miranda talks about Miranda doesn't require invocation of the right to counsel only after Miranda warnings are given. I mean, if the defendant or if the suspect is in the interrogation environment, if it's clear that interrogation is coming, then and he then asked for counsel, that's a valid invocation. I think that the words of these officers clearly indicated he was about to be questioned.
Your client invoked the right to counsel after he was placed in custody, correct?
Excuse me?
Your client invoked the right to counsel after he was placed in custody,
yes.
Correct?
Yes. He also, the other reason that I think that this was the interrogation environment and hence an adequate invocation of the right to counsel is the actions of the police officers. Again, they approached him directly. They were clearly looking for him. They stood in a way that he could not walk away, and they wanted to talk to him about drug transactions. That, I believe, is an interrogation environment. And
Ms. Askins, mm-hmm. Do you think that the state's alternative argument that he invoked his right to counsel but it was too early is a somewhat novel argument?
Well, I think it's I wouldn't say it's a novel argument, but I think it's pushing the envelope in terms of the facts here. Certainly if my client, you know, when I think of an anticipatory request for counsel, I'm thinking that a young man, say a similar young man who says, I see your police officers and I'm not going to talk to you, I want a lawyer. That would be anticipatory. But a police officer who approaches you and says, I want to talk to you about some crimes, I would say that's clearly a timely the time to say, I want a lawyer. And I would think that that would be a time that we would be advising somebody to invoke the right to counsel.
Maybe I'm confused. I thought that the dividing line or the distinction on whether something was anticipatory or not was whether or not they were placed in custody. Under Hassel and Kramer. I thought that was the distinction. So if you're in custody, the Miranda-Edwards line kicks in. If you're not in custody, that the cases say you can't, in anticipation, invoke your privilege against self-incrimination or invoke the right to counsel before you're placed in custody. Am I reading that wrong?
No. What I understood the state to be arguing was that he wasn't being interrogated, so he couldn't ask for a lawyer. There's no dispute that he was in custody. The way I understood the state's argument was there was no interrogation, so he can't ask for a lawyer. So that's what I was trying to clarify. You're correct on the cases. Now, going back to the question about Fisher, first of all, in Fisher, the request for counsel was equivocal. So we have that as background. The other thing was that Fisher was, if I remember correctly, in the context of a search. I'm sorry, I'm thinking of a different one. I had to refresh my recollection on Fisher. I do think that what occurred in Fisher was the functional equivalent of interrogation. Now, the court concluded that it wasn't interrogation because Fisher was asking questions about the evidence and the police officer was simply responding. I think under my argument, Fisher would be interrogation. They correctly state the test, so it's not a matter of getting the test wrong. And the facts are different here in that in Fisher you have a person who seems to be a little bit more sophisticated asking very detailed questions about the facts of those crimes and the officer giving detailed answers in response. This is Mr. Hambly's case is much more, I think, a kid saying, what is going on? What is happening to me? We're talking about, what we know now is that these supposed drug transactions occurred a long time previously. So the level of detail really in those questions is different. But, to respond to your question, Your Honor, I think that the Court of Appeals answered that question wrong.
I can't find my Fisher right now.
Okay.
I'm fishing for it. But it had a reference to Innes.
Mm-hmm.
And in referencing Innes, it said something to the effect that Innes declined to, it was around, I had marked in my notes, paragraph 34 of the Fisher case, that Innes declined to adopt a per se rule. And the per se rule sounds a little bit like the rule that you are advancing here, you know, when in custody and these kinds of questions are asked.
Right.
So how do you deal with that, that at least Fisher, through interpreting Innes, says no to your response?
Well, you're right, Your Honor. At paragraph 34 of Fisher, the Court says, Innes did not adopt a per se rule that whenever a law enforcement officer confronts a suspect with incriminating evidence or verbally summarizes the states against the suspect, the officer engages in the functional equivalent of express questioning. And I think that's true. There is not a per se rule. The bright line rule that I am asking the Court to insert into this line of cases is when a law enforcement, well, let me back up, when the defendant, the suspect asks for counsel, and then we say the suspect asks a question of law enforcement officer should first thing state, you have asked for a lawyer. If the person then goes on to waive their right to counsel, then those questions are answered really about whether this is the functional equivalent of interrogation. But really what this says is we don't say that an answer to a direct question is a per se violation of Innes. And I would agree with that. I think it's awfully hard to say that these words in response to a direct question will be interrogation, whereas these words will not. Cunningham talks about that as well. If, however, the officer prefaces any comments with, you've asked for a lawyer, I want you to understand that anything you say means you're waiving that right to a lawyer, that would go a long ways to clarify what follows. Then, but absent that, if the officer answers the question of the suspect, a case-by-case inquiry has to occur whether or not that constituted the functional equivalent of interrogation, that is, whether it tended to elicit an incriminating response. I see my light is on.
I always thought the difference between Fisher and this case is that the Court held in Fisher that there was no clear, unambiguous request for counsel. So
I think that was key. I mean, that was the first level of the inquiry, was he didn't really ask for a lawyer.
There's not questioning that he made an
No.
So he made an unambiguous, unequivocal request for counsel.
That has never been disputed.
And you're not arguing Sixth Amendment, you're arguing Fifth, of
Correct.
Course.
Correct.
All right. And your position, if I understand it, is that that should have ended questioning and it should have ended any further discussion.
That's right.
Now I'm going to get confused as to the cases. Is this the case where they said you can get a lawyer when you go down to the police station?
Yes.
So that was their response to about an attorney.
He reportedly said, we'll get you a lawyer when we get you down to the jail. And then there were more discussions in the back of the squad car while the other detective was searching the car.
A Miranda does not require you to do it in the police station, does it?
Doesn't require to that, do what?
That the only time the lawyer can be gotten is.
No. No. Clearly not.
Right. Thank you.
Thank you.
Assistant Attorney General Margaret Mohler, arguing on behalf of the state of Wisconsin. Good afternoon, counsel.
Good afternoon. May it please the Court. The state's position on this appeal is threefold. First of all, the request that Mr. Hambly made to call an attorney did not constitute an invocation of his Fifth Amendment right to counsel. Second, even if this court finds that it did constitute the invocation of his Fifth Amendment right to counsel, it was Hambly who initiated the discussion with Detective Rindt that eventually led to him being Mirandized and waiving his Miranda warnings and giving an incriminating statement. Finally, if this court rejects the state's position on both of those issues, the admission of that incriminating statement was harmless error under the facts of this case. Preliminary issue that was raised for the first time in this court, not addressed by the trial court or the Court of Appeals, is whether Hambly's request that he be allowed to call a lawyer made immediately upon being handcuffed constituted a sufficient invocation of his Fifth Amendment right to have counsel present during custodial interrogation. If this court were to decide that his request does not so qualify, then the question of whether there was an Edwards versus Arizona violation evaporates, because the record is abundantly clear that once Detective Rindt told Hambly he could call his lawyer upon their arrival at the jail, and that would be approximately a 20-minute trip from the location of where Hambly was arrested, Hambly never once from that point on asked to speak to an attorney. So if his request for a lawyer, which was made pretty much simultaneously with the handcuffs being put on him, if that did not qualify, then it really makes no difference whether Detective Rindt's explanation for why Hambly was being arrested amounts to the functional equivalent of interrogation under Rhode Island versus Innis and this court's decision in State versus Cunningham.
Ms. Mola, let me ask you about that. I didn't have a lot of time to grab a lot of cases, but I just grabbed one off the books in anticipation of this argument. State versus Sumatra Collins in 122 was second, page 320 and page 328. And that was a case, much like many of the cases that this court has seen over the years, where upon the arrest, and I'll just quote from the opinion, here Collins invoked his right to counsel while at his home immediately after being arrested. After he was taken to the police station, Officer Jones and Jordan initiated an interrogation in the absence of counsel and obtained incriminating statements from him. And under that fact scenario, the Court of Appeals in that case applied the Edwards rule. And I know that that has been done in many cases, many published opinions in this jurisdiction and in other jurisdictions. And it reminds me of a time back in practice days when I know that many attorneys, when they take clients in to turn themselves in, at the time of turning the client in, will hand in the client's presence an invocation of right to counsel at that time to the officer upon being arrested, with the idea that, okay, we may or may not talk to you, but not outside the presence of counsel. Now, as I understand your argument, that would be a significant change from at least the practice that I recall when I was doing it, and from the cases like Collins and other cases that have held that the dividing line is when you're arrested, not when they begin the interrogation. It'd be interesting your response.
I can't speak to exactly what your practice was or your experience was, but I think it's clear from cases like Illinois versus Perkins, a U.S. Supreme Court case, that the whole premise underlying the Miranda decision is that coercion results from the interaction of custody and interrogation, and that you have to have both of them before Miranda safeguards kick in. And in this particular case, I think you only had custody. I don't think you had interrogation at the time he asked to speak to an attorney, because there was no indication at that point that the officers intended to question Mr. Hambly right on the spot. When they went to his apartment, first they went to the apartment, found he wasn't home, they waited for him in the parking lot. Their goal was to get him to cooperate with the police in possibly ensnaring some people who might be higher up, shall we say, in the food chain, in drug trafficking in Washington County. Their goal at that point was not necessarily to arrest him. So when they approached him, they said, "We'd like to talk to you about some drug transactions you're involved in. how about if you come down to the station, meet us there? And he said, no. Then the second question was, well, what about if we go into your apartment, since they were right in the parking lot? What if we go to your apartment and talk about it? And he said, no. And then they finally said, well, is there some place we can talk? And basically Hambly said, no, I don't want to talk to you. Come back some other day. And it was at that point that they arrested him. So these preliminary questions about wanting to speak to him about drug transactions he was involved in, I don't think even constitute interrogation in the traditional sense of the word. These were preliminary inquiries trying to see if he would voluntarily cooperate with the drug unit.
And as I understand Hassel and Kramer, if he had invoked his right to counsel at that point prior to the arrest, it would seem to me that the argument that you made out of arising from Hassel and Kramer would kick in. I guess the concern that I have with the argument is this appears to be the first time I'm familiar with where it's actually being used after arrest.
Well, I think Hassel and Kramer dealt with the whole issue of when you're not in custody at the time. And I was simply citing those cases by analogy to say, in those cases, you didn't have custody, but you did have the interrogation. But that absent one or the other, Miranda simply is not implicated. And then there are a series of cases cited in our brief from other jurisdictions that indicate that even if you've got somebody in custody, if there is no indication that interrogation is going to be taking place right there, then the Miranda safeguards do not apply. And that would also explain why the officers here had not given Miranda warnings to Hambly at the time, because, first of all, they were hopeful that he would voluntarily talk to them, and it was only when he rebuffed their attempts that they said, okay, we're putting you under arrest. And as soon as he said he wanted to talk to a lawyer, their response was very direct. You can call him as soon as we get to the jail. And the jail was about, they estimated, 15 to 20 minutes away. So Hambly was told that his contact with the lawyer was forthcoming. Not that they were going to question him before that lawyer was contacted. And instead of just waiting till they got there, he said, I don't understand why I'm being arrested. And at that point, Detective Rindt explained, because you sold cocaine to Michael Meyer on three occasions, and he was cooperating with the drug unit. And according to Hambly, that explanation amounted to the functional equivalent of interrogation. And the state vehemently disagrees with this, because all that Detective Rindt was doing was explaining the basis for his arrest. And I find it interesting that opposing counsel does not really explain what exactly was Detective Rindt limited to saying in response to Hambly's inquiry. If he had just said, we're arresting you for a drug delivery, Hambly would have still said, I don't understand. Because the fact of the matter is, the last drug delivery he was being arrested for had taken place 6 months prior to this encounter in the parking lot. So giving him a little bit of the factual basis for the arrest, at least, I think, helped him to make a more intelligent decision on whether he wanted to speak to the officers. If somebody approached you and said you're being arrested, a police officer approached you and said you're being arrested, and the officer wouldn't tell you why, certainly that would not help you to make an intelligent decision on whether you'd be willing to talk to them. If you think you're being arrested for something very serious, you might have a different reaction than if you're being arrested for operating while intoxicated or some lesser crime in the greater scheme of things. And I think Justice Butler hit the nail on the head when he said, if the officers refused to tell Hambly why he was being arrested at that point, then we'd be hearing the argument that this is coercive because you're just kind of letting me hang there, and I want to get that information because I want to know why you're taking me into custody. He already had been told right from the outset that the officers were investigating or looking into drug transactions he was involved in. So he already knew the subject matter of the investigation. And simply telling him that he sold cocaine on three occasions and that Michael Meyer was working with the police, I don't think amounts to the functional equivalent of interrogation.
I was going to ask, with respect to the functional equivalent of interrogation argument, if the court accepts the trial court's finding that the defendant initiated conversation after the invocation of right to counsel under Edwards, do we need to reach the issue of functional equivalent, or does that answer the question?
That answers the question. If that answers the first part of the, I think it's Oregon versus Bradshaw inquiry. If you, first of all, find that his request for a lawyer was a valid invocation of the Fifth Amendment right, then if he reinitiated the contact with Detective Rindt, then the second question is, was his subsequent waiver of the Miranda, of his Miranda right to counsel, was that waiver knowing and voluntary? So it takes out, really, I think, the whole question of functional equivalent of interrogation.
I thought the initiation question, though, is separate, can be separate and independent of the knowing and voluntary.
It is. It's a two-part inquiry. But first you have to have a finding that it was the defendant or the suspect who initiated the conversation. If you were to answer that question as no, he never initiated the conversation, and you also found that there was an invocation, then the state would be left with a harmless error argument. But it's our position that the initiation clearly came from Hambly. First, he asked or wanted to know why he was being arrested, and then when he was told why he was being arrested, he made statements to the effect of, I'd like to talk to you, and I want to find out what my options are. And I think under the plurality test in Oregon versus Bradshaw, that this would constitute initiation.
Counsel, why not keep things simple? And I think that the bright line rule advanced by the defense has a certain simplicity. You know, rather than hearing after hearing and contesting who said what and what was said first and does this constitute initiation, did the defendant then initiate or was it, you know, and every fact different, why not just say, hey, look, you know, the law is clear that if he invokes and validly invokes right to counsel, there shouldn't be further interrogation. I mean, that law is boilerplate, boom, boom, boom. And if the defendant initiates, or the defendant starts talking, other than where's the restroom, you know, if the defendant starts talking, then the officer should say, hey, you know, you've requested the lawyer, and make that clarification and indicate that, you know, if you're going to talk, it can be used against you, etc. I mean, it just seems to me that that would just tighten up everything. And then we wouldn't have to be here, and circuit courts around the state wouldn't have to be here, wondering, was this really the functional equivalent of interrogation? I mean, it's also esoteric. Just have that as a rule. Simple, pragmatic, let's get on with it. What's wrong with that?
I think what's wrong with that bright-line rule, as it's been called, is that an unspoken underlying rationale for the rule is the belief that having voluntary confessions is somehow bad. I think it's important to recall the words of the court in McNeil versus Wisconsin, where the court said that the ready ability to obtain uncoerced confessions is not an evil, but it's an unmitigated good.
I'll tell you what an evil is. So evil is all, some of this esoteric stuff that's needless. Voluntary confessions are good. You know, I like voluntary confessions.
And I agree with that.
Yeah, that's right. But also, the law is good that when someone invokes their right to counsel, and that's sacrosanct, that's part of our Constitution, that if they're going to relinquish that right, it just should be clear that we're doing it. And we shouldn't have to waste judicial resources or resources of law enforcement officers or people around the state to determine the esoteric question of whether or not it's the functional equivalent of interrogation. One more question would have taken care of this. You wouldn't be up here, and not that I don't want you up here, but it just seems such a pragmatic, simple response. Let's do it. Get it over with.
I think it sounds simple, but I think as a practical matter that all you would be doing is exchanging one esoteric question for another, because then all the litigation would start revolving around the sufficiency of the clarification. Did the officer say the right words in trying to clarify whether the defendant really wanted to invoke his right to counsel?
They can get it right off TV. You know, you've just invoked your right to counsel. Do you realize now that anything you say can and will be held against you?
Well, they're getting it off TV right now by having to give the Miranda warnings, and that's what happened in this case. The Miranda warnings, which have been in existence for over 30 years, were read to him. He was given a chance to look them over himself, and he signed a written waiver. I think that is a good clarification. I don't think we need to add another layer of clarification, because those warnings came before he ever made the statement that is the subject of this appeal. The statement about having helped out Michael Meyer on a few times and giving him a couple lines of cocaine, that statement did not come when Detective Rindt said, you're being arrested because you sold cocaine to Michael Meyer three times and he was cooperating with the drug unit. That's not when he made that statement. He made the statement later on in the squad car after he had been read his Miranda rights, he'd had a chance to read them, and he signed a written waiver. So I think under the facts in this case, that would be a sufficient clarification about whether he really wanted to talk to a lawyer.
Well, can I? It's my understanding your first line of argument here is that there was no equivocal request for a lawyer. You're
not
saying,
so much equivocal. I'm saying that okay, very.
There was no request for a lawyer that fit the Fifth Amendment
when
he said, "I want a lawyer." So he's in his house and comes out, and they say, "You're under arrest." And he said, "I want a lawyer. I want a lawyer. I want a lawyer." He's all the way down to the police car, and he says, "I want a lawyer. I want a lawyer." And it's a 20-minute ride, and he wants a lawyer. Wants a lawyer. Everybody's absolutely quiet for him. Nobody says a word to him. He gets to the police station, and then they start questioning him or commenting to him. Let's just keep it. He still has not made, in your opinion, a request for a lawyer. Under the Fifth Amendment.
Right. Under your facts, he hasn't been given his Miranda warnings.
So not
he's just being taken to the station and spontaneously.
Right. And he keeps saying, I want a lawyer.
Right.
30 times.
And if they don't intend to question him, the police do not have to give him a lawyer at that point.
Right.
It's only if they want to interrogate him while he's in custody that they have to either let him get a lawyer or tell him that if he is indigent, a lawyer will be provided for him before any custodial interrogation takes place.
Have to have interrogation and the request both occurring in order for him to have made a Fifth Amendment request.
There either has
position.
To, that in order to make it a valid Fifth Amendment invocation, not anticipatory, there has to either be interrogation or that interrogation is, as some of the cases from, I think, the Seventh Circuit might say, imminent.
All right.
Could I ask, under present law, would the post-Miranda warning discussion be recorded?
I think that I'm not sure in terms of the capability of all squad cars. I don't know whether all squad cars in this state are equipped with the kind of technology that would allow for the recording, but I think under the statute that if the interrogation occurred and was not recorded, the defendant would be entitled to an instruction telling the jury or the judge would be aware of the fact that there's I'm not sure of the exact wording of the statute, but a presumption that there should have been a recording made of the entire interrogation. I'm sorry that I don't know the exact wording of the statute. So I can't say whether or not this interrogation would be recorded today, because I'm not sure technologically if the Washington County squad cars are equipped with that kind of ability.
Would recording of interrogation under these circumstances clarify the need for a bright line rule?
I think that recording in this case would have been extremely helpful, because you'd have a factual record that is murky, to say the best, because you've got Mr. Hambly introducing a four-page statement that he wrote out himself 2 days after his arrest, and that came in at the suppression hearing. And some of the statements that he made in that four-page written statement are disputed by the testimony at the suppression hearing, but there weren't specific fact findings made in a lot of instances. So I think having an actual recording of what went on, the chronology would be a lot easier to understand, and I think it would also make it more clear as to whether he really understood what was happening in terms of his waiver of the right to counsel, as opposed to this statement that he gave that he thought he was signing his own arrest warrant or something of that nature. So this is a good example of where interrogation being recorded would have been very helpful.
I wonder if it is, because it's your position that although lots of things were said, they didn't constitute interrogation. So as I hear your argument, just because things are being said doesn't constitute interrogation. And so if you're talking about recording of everything that was said, that's one thing. But if you're talking about recording of interrogation, then you still get into the issue of what's the functional equivalent of interrogation and the arguments that you're advancing. Am I right or wrong?
Well, no, you're correct there, because in the sense that if you're only required to record a custodial interrogation, then the question would come up, when did the custody begin? So I suppose in that sense, if you simply had the recording of the statements that were made once they got to the squad car, then it would not necessarily, you're correct, resolve the initial argument that we're raising, that there was no Fifth Amendment invocation.
There was no interrogation.
But you're not arguing that anything after the Miranda warnings was not interrogation, are you?
Oh, no, not at all. We agree that that was interrogation, but that at that point he had initiated the conversation that led to the discussion, and also that he had made a knowing and a voluntary waiver of his right to counsel under Miranda.
Counsel, let me ask you a fact question, because the facts, at least to me, appear to be a little bit unusual, not quite where you would expect to see them lining up in a case. And if I can just paraphrase, because I'm wondering if the cases really cover this type of a situation. You have an individual who's coming out of the McDonald's wanting to eat. Can we talk to you? No. Can we talk to you here? No. Can we talk to you there? No. Can we talk to you somewhere? No. Fine, you're under arrest. I want to talk to a lawyer. You can talk to a lawyer when you get back to the station. Well, why am I under arrest? Now, I've tried to paraphrase as best I could what the parties seem to agree to be the chronology of the facts. And I know there's some factual disputes in the middle layer in terms of whether or not he was told he couldn't have a lawyer right then or whatever. But taking those facts in that chronology, the thing that concerns me is you have an individual who is, at least from appearances sake, if you're the individual, you're arrested because you would not talk. And then when you say you want a lawyer, you're told you can have one when you get to the station, so about a 20-minute ride. And you're asking, but why are you arresting me? And I'm wondering if that's the type of a fact scenario that was contemplated when we're talking about these really clear lines, these bright lines about who initiated the conversation, whether or not we have separate conversations. I don't know that this is clearly answered by that type of a scenario, those cases really answer this type of a scenario. And I'm a little bit concerned about that. So I was wondering if you could comment, given the unique circumstances of this particular facts case.
Well, I think that based on what happened here, Mr. Hambly could have thought, and apparently based on his written statement, he did think that he was being arrested because he was refusing to meet with the officers. And to some extent, that might be true in the sense that they were hoping to get his cooperation, and when they didn't, they did have enough to arrest him. They had probable cause. There's, you know, no question about that. But I think once you get beyond that, then the question, why am I being arrested, or I don't understand why I'm being arrested, we still have the case law that talks about even after you've made an invocation of your right to counsel under Miranda, and I'm assuming for this portion of my argument that he did make a valid invocation, as long as he, the defendant, is the one who initiates the conversation that eventually leads to him getting the Miranda warnings and making a statement, then the Edwards rule is not violated. And I think here when you look at him asking, why am I being arrested, and the officer telling him, and then him making the further statement, I would like to talk to you and I want to know what my options are, that opens up the discussion under Oregon versus Bradshaw. I believe that qualifies as initiation. So once you have initiation, then the only remaining question is whether when he executed his Miranda waiver, was that knowing and voluntary? And the state only has to prove that by a preponderance of the evidence, and I think the state clearly did that here because you've got the officer reading him the rights, and I think the trial court made a specific factual finding that Detective Rindt did read the rights, gave Hambly the piece of paper, he looked at them, and he signed. He actually filled out yes and no on the form. Yes,
Ms. Mueller. Let me ask you this. Opposing counsel argued that there really should be a break, and there was no break here. Now, do the cases require that there be a break?
I don't, first of all, think that any of the cases that are cited in opposing counsel's brief for this proposition deal with the kind of situation we have here where you first have an approach by officers to get a voluntary discussion going. The cases all involve a situation where a Miranda warning was given to a person who was in custody. There was some interrogation, and then at some point the defendant or suspect said, I don't want to talk anymore. I want my lawyer. Or actually, there has to be a break on the silence cases. If you invoke your right to silence, there has to be a break. If you invoke your right to counsel, simply having a break isn't enough. You also have to have the initiation. But I don't think any of those cases stand for the proposition that what happened here is somehow out of bounds because it went directly from putting the handcuffs on, I want a lawyer, tell me why I'm being arrested, and the officer explaining it. I don't think there's any requirement, in answer to your question, that there has to be some definite temporal break there.
And there was not here, obviously.
Not really, but there was this break in terms of when he gave the incriminating statements because there was time for him to be taken out of the back of the squad, read the Miranda rights, and brought to the front seat to sign the waiver. So there is that kind of a break before he actually made the statement that the prosecution introduced against
him. This was all going on while his car was being searched by the other officer, incident to the arrest, right?
Correct. Detective Closing was conducting a search of Hambly's vehicle at the time. So for all of the reasons advanced in today's argument and in our brief, the state would ask this court to affirm the decision of the Court of Appeals upholding Scott Hambly's conviction.
What is the minimal holding of this court in this case that would support allowing the statements in? It seems to me the broadest holding that you're asking for is to say when, after the police say, we want to talk to you about a criminal offense, and that the defendant says, I want a lawyer. He doesn't say, I want a lawyer to do bail. He doesn't say, I want a lawyer to talk about whether I have to talk to you. He just says, I want a lawyer. and that perhaps a reasonable person would construe "I want a lawyer" as an expression of a desire for the assistance of an attorney in dealing with custodial interrogation. That's, I'm reading from McNeil as to what the request for lawyer is. So, you want to say that's not under McNeil. But if you say it's under McNeil and that that is a good custodial request, then you have to go to functional equivalent, which is Innis and that line of cases, and then find a voluntary intelligent waiver, right? Okay. That would be the narrowest holding. Is that right?
Right. It would be, right. It would be narrower to find that, assuming he did have a proper invocation, then under Edwards, you have to have a two-step inquiry. Did the defendant initiate the conversation, which we would say, yes, that this comment about why you were arrested was not interrogation? And after that, the question is, did his subsequent Miranda waiver, was it knowing and voluntary?
And they'd be supported in the record. The trial court's findings on those would be supported in the record as to voluntary and intelligent waiver.
Yes.
Although that is ultimately a question of law.
Correct. We ask you to affirm the trial court's conclusion of law, but as well its factual findings that led up to that determination.
What's your best case that says that his saying, "I want a lawyer," is not an invocation? What's your best case?
I'm not really sure. I thought that the Fisher case was...
No, but they found there that it was equivocal.
I'm sorry?
They found there that it was equivocal whether he asked for a lawyer or not. I mean, I think I read the right part for you.
Yeah.
So I don't know the Fisher. I'm wondering if you do have any case that really supports what you ask for, which doesn't make any difference. There may not be a case, and you've got a good theory of the law here, but I didn't see it. And the Legrone Federal Seventh Circuit case, there his request for a lawyer was very narrow. He wanted to know whether they could search the market. Not, he didn't talk about generally in custody what he wanted a lawyer for.
So I guess I'm really sorry that I can't think of one of the cases that I referred
okay,
to.
Okay, I'll look at your briefs again. Okay. Not a problem.
Thank you very much.
Counsel. Counsel. Ms. Saskins.
I wanted to comment on the harmlessness argument that the state made, and I would point the court to both the opening statement by the prosecutor to the jury, appears at page 114 of the first day of trial. In outlining what the case is going to be against my client, the state argues to the jury that Hambly gave an incriminating statement. And then again in closing at page 226 of the transcript, in closing argument to the jury, the prosecutor says, outlines the evidence against my client and argues that because the defendant made this admission, that was also a reason why the jury should convict. And so I think that given the arguments that the prosecutor made to the jury shows that this really was not harmless error, and I would add that to the arguments that I made in my brief. I wanted to comment, I think I was not entirely clear about the questions relating to Hassel and Kramer, and I would refer the court to my reply brief at page 4. I think that the state is pushing those cases into areas that had not argued before, because in Hassel and Kramer, those suspects were not in custody, and so they couldn't invoke their right under Miranda. And again, I think I argue at that point in my brief why I think those arguments go too far. I think I also agree that the facts are unusual in this case. One reason is that I think that my client was so clear that he wanted counsel. And that is somewhat unusual. The other thing that I think is unusual and that I think is potentially frightening in a way is that to imagine being arrested when you don't have a clue why. And I think, as the state pointed out, the events in this case had occurred, you know, some 6 months earlier. And I think that it must be really intimidating to have people approach you, say you're under arrest for drug transactions, and when you say you want a lawyer, to say that they want to talk to you about drug transactions, and then when you invoke your right to counsel, you're arrested.
Counsel, to what extent are you relying or arguing, and you can either do it at the front end or at the back end on in terms of voluntary. Your client, if I understand it, was 19.
Correct.
He had not yet graduated from high school.
Correct.
Well, what's in the record about his mental ability or his experience with the criminal justice system?
His experience with the criminal justice system was as a juvenile. He did have some experience. I think your maybe a good source for that, again, is the judge's sentencing comments.
But was that considered in terms of the waiver?
Well, the judge did talk about, he kind of went back and forth about not being sure whether Scott really understood what was happening to him. In many ways seemed just like he didn't understand what was happening to him. He knew enough to ask for a lawyer, but he didn't really understand the process. Maybe I should say. Most people don't. I mean, the judge says at the sentencing, I think you have certain limitations. It's never really clear what those limitations are, but certainly that's why I earlier said I think he's different from Fisher, because I think he's young. He's just barely older than the juvenile cases that we dealt with. And even his written statement, I think, shows a certain level of naivete or unsophistication.
The judge didn't make those findings in terms of knowing and voluntary.
The judge said, he said at page 5, he may not have had the level of sophistication in the criminal law that the state offers. He understood his rights, including a right to counsel. So he, you know, on the one hand says he doesn't have a level of sophistication. On the other hand, the judge seems to think that he knew enough to waive.
Okay. Thank you.
If I can follow up.
Yeah.
My understanding, and correct me if I'm wrong, his level of understanding would only be relevant with respect to the waiver issue if the court were to find coercion, correct?
Correct. To a very small degree, his special susceptibilities would be relevant for purposes of evaluating whether the police officer's comments were likely to elicit a response. For example, if you know that your suspect is deeply religious and you invoke the notion of the Christian burial, that might, of course, tend to elicit an incriminating response. But primarily it goes to waiver. Thank you.
Thank you, counsel. Thank you, Ms. Mueller, and thank you, Ms. Askins, for, again, arguing before this court as players in the criminal justice system. This discussion about violation of the Fifth Amendment rights. This concludes our hearing in 2005, AP 3087 Sierra State of Wisconsin versus Hambly. The court will meet in a closed conference at 3:15, and we will be here in oral arguments at 9:45 tomorrow.